Hi everybody, today is Monday, June 2nd, 2025, and our friend Colonel Jacopo is back with us. Welcome back, Colonel.
Thank you very much for inviting me again and to be back with you.
Colonel, we had Ukrainians attack Russian nuclear bombers and had some sort of explosion in the railroad in Bryansk and in the line between Bryansk and the Kursk region. And we know that your book about covert wars in Ukraine would be has been published in French, but tomorrow will be announced on Amazon. When you look at the situation right now in Ukraine and the way that Zelensky, we were talking about it before coming to live. You talk about the tactical wars, these tactics that have been replaced, the strategies that have been replaced by tactics. Zelensky is not asking for something strategic for Ukraine. He's asking for more weapons, for more money to Ukraine to continue the conflict in Ukraine without having any sort of outcome in his mind. And your take on that, and let's start with your book and then go after the conflict in Ukraine.
Well, when I saw this operation, which by the way was a half successful operation, but let's be courageous and say successful, although I'm not sure it reached all the objectives that were set for the operation. But anyway, it's by and large a successful operation. But first I thought, well, the Ukrainians, Zelensky has decided to promote my book because my book deals exactly with that kind of operations. And the way both Russians and Ukrainians approach covert war when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine. And we see that on both sides, you don't have the same weight on covert operations, for instance. There are some from on the Russian side, but we see that the Ukrainians put much more emphasis on that. And that is something that was predictable and predicted, because I remember at the beginning of last year, 2024, I said in a conference that because the situation on the ground was always more unfavorable for Ukraine, they would go to asymmetric warfare, because that's the only way for them to achieve some kind of success. And that was also said, by the way, during a meeting that happened early 2024 in the US, that was said by Kirill Budanov, the head of the military intelligence, that Ukraine will rely more on asymmetric warfare. And the idea is, and that's where you have an interesting twist to the use of covert operations, because if you look at how the Russians use covert operations, typically you had this in Sudja with this infiltration through the gas, the pipeline. We see that the Russians tend to use covert operation for having military success, while the Ukrainians tend to use covert operation to achieve political success. And it's more like a PR operation rather than to achieve a success that's in support of the ground operations on the ground. And remember, for instance, the number of operations that were conducted against the Kerch Bridge. Although everybody knows that the Kerch Bridge is no longer used by the military since 2022, in fact. It's for pure civilian use, because now the Russians have rehabilitated the whole railroad between Russia and Crimea on land, so on the land bridge, as it is called, as well as the road networks, which was extremely poor in Ukraine. I remember when I was there in 2014 that it took a lot of time to move on the roads in Ukraine because the road network was extremely poor condition. Now the Russians have made those road now extremely comfortable and usable for logistical purposes, so they don't need a Kerch bridge anymore. But there is a constant focus of even today, by the way, by the Ukrainians and their British mentors to focus on that bridge because it has a symbolic dimension. And that's very much what we have seen in this operation yesterday in Russia that aimed at targeted strategic airfields or airfields for strategic aviation, with probably the idea that they would destroy the fleet of strategic bombers like the Tupolev 95 and Tupolev 160 and things like this. But they failed to do so. Reportedly, we talk about 40 aircraft that were destroyed. But again, I haven't seen the official figures at this stage, but what we have seen on social networks and all that tends to point at something like probably 10 strategic bombers. I don't know if this figure is correct, if it's too less or too much. I don't know, but from what I have seen, I don't have the impression that they've achieved the objective of imposing a strategic blow to Russia. It is a blow in the sense that, of course, it's a successful operation, in the sense that they achieved some objective. They managed to bring those drones close to those airfields. And if you look at the one that was targeted in Amur, the Amur military district or oblast, sorry, at the far east of Russia, it's about 4,000 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. So it's a huge distance. And that shows also a level of coordination in terms of putting in place the logistic, because all these drones on the five airfield where they were used, probably I can show, I think a map that shows the, that we have, sorry, here we have the five sites. Murmansk up in the north, the Olenia Air Base, Ivanovo, that's east of Moscow, the Ivanovo Air Base, in the Ryazan, southwest of Moscow, at the Diaghilev Air Base. Then you had Irkutsk in Siberia, at the Belaya Air Base, and in Amur, the Ukrainka Air Base. So these are huge distances that pose a number of problems. I mean, first of all, you have to drive there. You need to have your drones into containers, and that's, I have to go back. I lost my, here we go, sorry. They were put in containers like this. These are kind of standard containers, but the upper level of the container, the roof, is hollow and has all these drones stored. And when you arrive on the site, you just open the roof of the container, and the drones can fly. And apparently, they are remotely controlled, meaning that you need to have the network to do that. You need to have a secure communication to achieve that. So it indicates a degree of sophistication, which obviously is not insignificant. And from a technical point of view, I would say, technical point of view, it's a success. When it comes to the operational strategic level, then I would say it's not a success because it failed to destroy a relevant number of aircraft on several targets or airfields were not even reached because for some reason the trailer was destroyed, because apparently there is a self-destroy mechanism in the on the container, meaning that probably if you try to open the doors or something like that, that leads to the self-destruction of the container. And apparently this happened a couple of times, probably because the driver for some reason tried to open the doors of the container or anything like this. I don't know exactly, but the fact of the matter is that they have been some self-destructed containers. So from that point of view, it was not a success. And when they arrived on site, on certain locations, even the local population, when they saw the drones coming out of the containers, they tried to destroy the container, or they tried to close the roof of the containers. And apparently they even tried to open the doors, and thus triggering the self-destruction mechanism. So we see that it's a half success from the operational strategy level. And as I said, probably unlike it was stated, probably only a few number of aircraft was effectively or definitely destroyed. But this is a tactical and technical achievement, we have to say that. But again, we are talking about something spectacular. We are talking about something that is, and especially that it came yesterday. So I mean, the day before the resumption of the talks in Istanbul. And obviously this was designed as a demonstration of force, a way to show, despite the failure on the battlefield, and remember that even the commander of the Ukrainian ground forces resigned yesterday because of the failure on the ground, and that's also related to a Russian strike on a training area where you had a number of military or soldiers, Ukrainian soldiers, that were killed despite the order to avoid any grouping on training fields and things like this, in order precisely to avoid this kind of situation. In any case, the head of the ground forces resigned, and showing that on the battlefield, Ukraine don't have success, and therefore they had to demonstrate some kind of success on the PR level, if you want. But it is not just the only rationale, because now we have the feeling, I mean, it's not the feeling, apparently there was some information that some Western intelligence was involved in the operation. And that's probably true, especially when it comes, for instance, for satellite communication or things like that, or data link, in order to achieve a kind of a secure communication between those who commanded the operation or conducted the operation and the drones on the ground. But there is another aspect, as I said, and this is what the Ukrainians have tried to do in the past year and a half or so. It is, as Zelensky himself said, that the Russians have to feel the war. And that's an interesting aspect, because in my book I made a comparison of the quote of Zelensky and the quote of the Islamic State, because you remember when we had this wave of attacks of the Islamic State in France, Belgium, and so on in 2015, 2016, 2017, the Islamic State made statements to explain what they want to achieve with those attacks. And incidentally, it covers exactly, this is exactly the same wording as the one used by Zelensky, meaning that the idea is to make the civilian population aware of the conflict, and in order to attack, the idea was to attack the civilian population so that the civilian population could make pressure on the government to stop the war. And that's exactly the rationale behind the attacks of the Islamic State in all the different countries. They were attacked, mostly France, but other countries such as Germany and so on. And that was explained in plain words. And Zelensky said exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same idea. To have the population attacked in order to create a political crisis in Russia and to destabilize the government. And that's the similarity in the approach of these attacks is seems to me very interesting, because it shows exactly the ethics that lies behind those actions. So it's not to achieve, or those operations are not in support to military operation on the ground, but they are designed to destabilize, they are designed to create political crisis by attacking civilian population. And that explains, because when we talked about the five airfields attacked, or the five air bases, we're talking about this operation Pavutina, which means a spider web. So that's a specific operation. But besides this, you had also in the Bryansk Oblast, you had also at least two attacks. I haven't got exactly whether it was two or three, but in any case, you had at least two bridges that collapsed and in fact provoked derailment of civilian trains. So there is this idea that the Russian population could be the target of this strategy. By the way, it could be fully consistent with what we have seen in the past year, where you had those attacks against Belgorod, Bryansk. Also, you had in the whole border area, including, although Kursk is probably, there is another rationale behind Kursk. Some say it's asymmetric warfare. I think Kursk has a specific rationale. It was to seize territory. It was not probably also to provoke a crisis in Russia. But the main purpose, as it was explained by Volodymyr Zelensky, was to take some territory and use it as bargaining chip in future negotiations. So it has that was an aim in itself, if you want. But for other attacks in the Belgorod district and all that, we could see that it was typically what you could define as a terrorist attack, by attacking civilian population and using that as a leverage to create a political crisis in Moscow. So we have here a distinct use of covert operation between Russians and Ukrainians, and that was exemplified by this operation Pavutina.
Yeah. Colonel, where does Europe stand today in Ukraine? And here is what Stormer is said about the new strategy on the part of the United Kingdom.
Today, following through on this review, I want to set out three fundamental changes that we're going to deliver. First, we are moving to warfighting readiness as the central purpose of our armed forces. When we are being directly threatened by states with advanced military forces, the most effective way to deter them is to be ready. And frankly, to show them that we're ready, to deliver peace through strength. Now, Britain has the finest service men and women in the world. We're showing them the respect that they deserve by delivering the biggest armed forces pay rise in 20 years and by pledging today that we will end the hollowing out of our armed forces. We'll build a fighting force that is more integrated, more ready, more lethal than ever, backed by a stronger strategic reserve, fully trained and ready to mobilize at any time.
Yeah, it's all about arm race. It's all about militarization of Europe. It's all about the future that is not going to be for the population in Europe. It's going to be for new conflicts, new wars for Europe. Your take on that?
Well, that's the same approach as you had in the European Union. Very interesting to see that in the European Union, they started also to have the same kind of approach. That means to rearm Europe. And by the way, this is the name of the operation that was started or initiated by Ursula von der Leyen. The interesting aspect is that we are exactly in a moment where the whole industry of Europe is collapsing. I mean, Volkswagen is closing factories in Europe. Mercedes is closing factories in Europe, opening them in US and in China. So we see that the industrial fabrics of Europe is collapsing. And apparently the European leaders, and that includes not just European Union, but also obviously Keir Starmer, they start to reindustrialize through the military industrial complex. That's very interesting. Nevertheless, we have to say that we have seen the reports, and there were several reports in the past, I would say the past year, by the way, since the British expressed their intent to have troops in Ukraine. I mean, you had many reports saying that, in fact, the British Army was no longer able to deploy so many soldiers and armored vehicles and forces, in one word, able to fight the Russians. And so meaning that there was an urgent need to restore the military capabilities that we once had in Europe. But that will take a lot of time. I mean, this is portrayed as a response to the situation in Ukraine. But, you know, an army is like an aircraft carrier. You don't change direction such easily. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of investments. It requires a lot of personnel. And today, there is no longer appetite from young British citizens to go in a conflict which will end up very clearly in Ukraine. And the number of British people who have died in Ukraine is quite staggering. I have probably here, I think, these are the figures of the mercenaries in just for the Kursk Oblast. So this is the only what the Russians have identified as a body, I mean, foreign bodies in the Kursk area. So it's not counting the rest of Ukraine. And you see that you had about 2,000 Poles, about 1,200 Georgians, almost 1,000 Colombians, 200 French, 200 British, Germans, 150 British soldiers. So we see that it apparently the Ukraine has been the cemetery of all these mercenaries and all that. And this is just for Kursk. The total of the mercenaries in Kursk is almost 5,000. So that doesn't take into account all the Ukrainians who died in the Kursk region. So that gives a small idea of how the dangerous is the battlefield in Ukraine. You know, during the Cold War, because it was a Cold War, you could afford, and by the way, in many armies, not all of them, but you had conscription, meaning that it was easy to achieve big armies, and people were confident that they would not fight, because it was precisely the purpose of having a strong army was precisely not to fight, because the whole dynamics, or let's say the strategy, was to have some kind of deterrent effect. Today, it's different, because the rhetoric that we have from the leaders is precisely to go and wage war against Russia. And we see that in many countries, you have the population is hesitant to join the armed forces, because they don't want to go to war in Ukraine. They don't want to go to war against Russia. They don't feel that Russia represents a decisive threat against the West. I think a lot of people understand that what we have heard from Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, and all that, Ursula von der Leyen, about the Russian threat is kind of made up by those leaders. As a result, there's a lack of confidence. And we have talked many times, by the way, that applies not just to that, but in many other areas, the population in Europe lacks the trust or confidence in their leaders. So rebuilding a successful armored force, or an effective armored force in the UK, will take a lot of time and many years. And in order to have investments in the military-industrial complex and all that, to restart lines of production for heavy equipment, aircraft, and all that, that will require a lot of investment. And the problem is that nobody knows exactly for how long. You know, when you want to invest in something, it cannot be just because one leader decided that we might make war. It's because you have a persistent threat that is identifiable, that you can say, okay, for the next 20 years, we'll have a threat. But today, nobody really accept that, in the sense that we understand that there's a conflict between Ukraine and Russia. Nobody is really convinced that Russia would like to attack Europe. Nobody is really convinced that Russia is a threat for Europe at large. And therefore, all these efforts that you want to make and for which you want to invest, for how long is your investment? You know, that was the problem that the Europe had last year, when they tried to restart the production of artillery ammunition in Europe. And you have a lot of factories that are able to produce artillery ammunition. But in order to multiply the number of the of shells produced every year, you need to expand your production line. That requires investment. But for how long? Is it just for 6 months? And therefore, why would you make so much effort just for 6 months? You know, the whole issue, this is exactly what we see today in the US and with the Trump policy and all that. People don't have the feeling that the decisions that are made today will still be valid in 6 months from now. Therefore, when you invest, are you really investing for just 6 months? You're just putting millions in a production chain just for 6 months or less? Nobody will do that. And that's exactly the problem. That's also the problem that you have for the LNG, for instance. The US can produce much more LNG that it does, in order, for instance, to provide LNG to Europe. But this requires terminals that are very sophisticated in order to liquefy the gas and transport them on ship. But in order to have those terminals, which are extremely sophisticated and require a lot of investment, people say, well, okay, we can do that, but for how long? Because if the Russians resume their production or their deliveries after a peace agreement or whatever, or if the US remove the sanctions, then all our investment to liquefy gas will be just lost. You see, you need to have a certain degree of certainty for the future in order to engage your money in a project. And that's exactly what is missing at each level in Europe, at military level, at economic level, at industrial level, and even at political level, because we see that all these governments that we have today are in a very precarious position, as we have seen in Germany, for instance. Who will be the next party leading Germany? So how can you make this long-term decisions in a political context that may change more quickly than expected? So
maybe they're preparing for World War III. That's because the level of insanity right now in Europe is unbelievable. That's why they're moving in that direction, because there is, as you mentioned, there is no logical strategy behind if you're not preparing for a bigger war, for a larger war.
Well, the problem is that we are in a situation today where everybody is caught on the back foot, if you want. It's taken on the back foot. We have said for 3 years now that Russians were losing the war and Ukrainians were winning. And now we are saying it's not the case. And that prompted Ukraine to start a new strategy based on asymmetric warfare, use of terrorism and all that. We have seen that since last year with the Crocus attack in the suburbs of Moscow and what we have seen yesterday. So this is the sign that the West becomes desperate, because what else can they do? The problem is that I think, despite everything, they try to push Ukraine into more war, but they know they are not able to wage war. That's, I think, behind the political narrative, people realize that they are not ready for war. And the fact that Keir Starmer is saying that they need to invest to rebuild the British military illustrates that point. And I think, yes, the leadership in Europe is irrational, but they understand at the same time that there's no really a way out of that, because they know that their military is not up to the mark to confront Russia. So that's my understanding. I say, yes, it's erratic. Yes, it's irrational. But at the same time, there is some kind of background of rationality, because they know they will not be able to achieve any kind of success against the Russian. And there is another factor also that is important to take into the equation, is the fact that the US is not ready to engage into that conflict. And I think the Europeans understand that. That's why the US is the strongest supporter of the discussion in Istanbul, even if they don't understand exactly what is at stake, even if I'm not sure they understand exactly what will be the Russian position, where they can... I'm not sure they understand exactly what they can achieve with those discussions. But definitely, they see that there is no other way than a negotiation. And that's already something which is important from the US side, because without the US, I doubt that the Europeans will have the courage and the capacities to engage or to provoke more deeply the Russians. So yes, it's irrational, but I think there is still a small rational dimension in that. So I wouldn't be so pessimistic in that sense. They will continue to provoke. They will continue to support terrorist actions and things like this. This may prompt some reaction. The positive aspect in the whole equation is that the Russian leadership is extremely rational, and they are also extremely patient. They are not looking for quick results and kind of a PR operations. They are more keen to achieve long-term results, even in the field. I mean, they would favor operational success to tactical success. You know, that's basically, we are talking about Clausewitz here. They consider the politics, the diplomacy as the continuation of war, or the war as continuation of politics with other means, meaning that they are not bound to one aspect, diplomacy or war. The Europeans are bound to that because they don't have any continuity between war and diplomacy. That's why they don't have diplomacy anymore, especially with the Russians. But the Russians, they have this continuity between the battlefield and diplomacy. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today in Istanbul. That, and that's also the reason why for them, stopping fighting is not exclusive to making war. You know, you can make war at the same time talking. That's what they have done in February 2022, what they have done in March, April 2022, and what they were ready to do in August 2022. So the war and diplomacy are two pillars of their security policy, and they play alternatively with one or the other. And they will pull the brake on military operation if diplomacy works. And if diplomacy doesn't work, they will pull the brake on diplomacy and accelerate on military operations. That's exactly the Clausewitzian principle, basically. And that's exactly what it has played from the Russian point of view, meaning that they can afford to be rational because they have those two pillars, those two tools or instruments they can play with. The Europeans don't have that, but they realize that this is missing. And I think it was last week that the Slovenian prime minister suggested, which is quite new, by the way, she suggested to have a quiet discussion or quiet diplomatic contact with the Russians. Meaning that even in the European Union, they realize that they need something. And one tool is missing to achieve the whole spectrum of effectiveness when it comes to the resolution of the Ukrainian conflict. So I'm on that side. I'm quite optimistic in the sense, because we have this Russian approach that is very pragmatic. And I don't know yet what the impact of the attack of yesterday will be in the negotiation. Probably we'll know that in the coming days. I don't know. But the Russians are enough they can deal with the matter so cold-bloodedly. So meaning that they can make the difference between a military operation, terrorist operation, and a political discussion. They will not mix up everything. And that, I think, is the hope I have for these negotiation. Again, I have no idea what will be the result. We note that those who don't want to negotiate are essentially the Europeans and Zelensky. So that's also something. And probably the fact that they, as we said before, that they launched this operation in Russia yesterday, including the two attacks on the railways in Bryansk region yesterday too, just before the resumption of the negotiation, is probably an indication that the Ukrainians are not looking for an appeasement. They are looking for trying to be in a better position to negotiate. They are looking for the, let's say, an advantage, but not for any appeasement. By the way, it's also important to underline that the decree that Zelensky signed and this decree that was adopted by the Ukrainian National Security Council in end of September 2022 and enacted on the 4th of October 2022 that prevents any negotiation with Russia has not been abrogated. Meaning, and nobody advised Zelensky to do that, showing that there is no real, let's say, commitment to a negotiated solution. And that indicates also that the Russians so far have a pragmatic approach to that because they don't know if any result achieved during the negotiation will be valid or not. Because there is still the risk that even if they achieve something positive, that the Ukrainian side said, well, but it's not valid because nobody was authorized to negotiate with Russia. So there is still this aspect that indicates that Russia at this stage is extremely pragmatic, say, okay, as long as it's not no, it's a yes. And therefore they will proceed in the negotiation. And the European / Ukrainian side is in fact playing with the words and saying, okay, we negotiate, but we are ready to abandon the negotiation as soon as possible. Again, this Ukrainian / European position is possible because there is this European delusion about the situation on the ground. And remember what Lindsey Graham was saying just a couple of days ago, was saying that Ukraine can win. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean? What is his definition of victory? What does it mean with that? You see, objectively, factually, you can really question the rationality of such assertion. So, but nevertheless, it is something which is widely understood in the European mindset, especially in the European Union, that there is still an opportunity for Ukraine to win something, regardless of, they don't define what it is, but there is this option. So we are in the fog of peace. We're no longer in the fog of war, but we are in the fog of peace because nobody knows exactly what the Ukrainians want to achieve. Of course, they say they want the Russians out of the borders of 1991, but at the same time, they refused this solution in April 2022. So now they have also to accept the consequences of their decision. So we are not exactly there. That's the reason why the Russians don't want to go back. I mean, they said, well, you had your chance. We were ready to leave Ukraine in April 2022. You decided to change that. Your proposal, because it was a Ukrainian proposal, it was not a Russian proposal. It was a Ukrainian proposal. It was signed by the Ukrainian delegation, and eventually, under pressure of the Europeans, Zelensky traded peace against unlimited support. Now he has unlimited support, which, by the way, is not unlimited, but de facto limited by the Western capabilities or capacities. And that's the problem. So he's trapped. He's trapped in his own decision.
Colonel, as time goes by with the conflict in Ukraine, it seems that with the level of support that the Ukrainians are receiving from the West, we know that is diminishing drastically. And I would wonder if these people, as you've mentioned, Lindsey Graham is talking about Ukraine winning, how it seems to me that they hate Ukrainians more than Russians. They're killing Ukrainians. They're not killing Russians. They're just destroying Ukraine and the future of Ukraine and anything that we call Ukraine today.
Well, it's a good question. I said, basically, my understanding is that they hate Russians just a little bit more than they hate Ukrainians. That's my
outcome. The outcome doesn't offer that. The outcome is tragic.
Absolutely. Yes, and but remember what Lindsey Graham was saying, that it was the best investment they could have for every dollar they were put in this war, because he said that was him or Richard Blumenthal, one of the two, because they are the two competing for fighting against Russia. In any case, one of the two said that it was a very good investment to support Ukrainians, because so they could weaken Russia without losing any single American life, as if Ukrainian life didn't matter. You see? So that was a very good investment, because, and that's, I think, this is where Lindsey Graham said that the Ukrainians are ready to fight up to the last one, you know? So that's fine. They are ready to die for us, because so we save our American lives. We just have to spend some dollars, but we can afford that. So, you know, this is this kind of despicable position. But I think a lot of Ukrainians start to realize this today, to be honest. Here in Europe, I am also invited on some channels, and I realized that those who are listening to my programs, which are considered by mainstream media as pro-Russian, but in reality, those who listen to my program, and I was stopped on the sidewalk here in Brussels many times by Ukrainians who thanked me for what I was saying, because they said, without you, we wouldn't know exactly what's happening in our country. So the problem is, and I think a lot of Ukrainians will at one point seek revenge against the Europeans. By the way, it's also very important, because when we talk about Ukraine, and obviously what you have in Ukraine, I'm not talking about the Russian part of Ukraine, if I can put it that way, even if Ukraine has always been a mix between the different cultures. But let's say the south and east of the country is mostly Russian, ethnic Russian, let's put it that way. In the rest of Ukraine, which is the center and the west, you obviously people who are, they have mixed feeling about the Russians. If you are in the center, you find people who are ready to accept the Russians, that they have nothing against the Russian per se. They're probably pro-European, probably. But if you go in the West, you have those who are the ultra-nationalists. And that's something I explain also in my book, by the way, in my last book, because it's very important to understand how the Ukrainian nationalism work. And there were very, very interesting studies made in the 50s by the CIA, because the CIA was planning operations in Ukraine against the Soviets. And you have a lot of planning documents that have been declassified since then that shows exactly the same thing you can observe today. But an interesting aspect of the ultranationalists in Ukraine, today they are allied of Europe because they are against Russia. But they are not in favor of the European Union. And that's very important to realize. They don't want the European Union. And you find a lot of demonstrations today of ultranationalists where they have the EU flag barred by a red cross because they don't want the European Union. They hate the Europeans. And that's interesting because in Europe, in the European Union, people don't realize this, that those Ukrainians who are ultranationalists, who in fact drive to some extent the policy of the current leadership in Ukraine, these people are not in favor of the European Union. They are in favor of a kind of a white Europe, you know, and if you look at the symbols that you have and the different units that are part of the Ukrainian forces, I mean, the mercenary units, if you want to call it that way. And also I describe all these units, and I also show the symbols of these units. You find those Celtic type of symbolic. I mean, we are back to the symbols that you have in the old white Christian Europe. You know, you're not with the symbolic of the European Union or things like this. It's another kind of Europe they are talking about. And it's closer to this white Europe that the Germans wanted to have in the 30s or things like that. This idea of a united Europe started in the 30s. I'm not saying that the European Union today is based on exactly the same ideas that were developed in Germany in the 30s. It's not what I'm suggesting. It was different ideas. But what we have in Ukraine today doesn't relate to what has been developed since World War II in Europe. It relates more to what was developed before World War II in Europe. That's the interesting aspect of that. So meaning that what we have in Ukraine is not something which will be not a population that might be grateful for the Europeans. They just consider that the Europeans are doing their duty in helping Ukrainians against the bad Russians, Soviets, or you name it. So this is also a distortion in our perception of the conflict. And that's something we need to understand in order to understand how people feel in Ukraine. But a lot of people in Ukraine do not belong to those ultranationalists. They are the victims of those ultranationalists. It's very important to say. By the way, that's also something I describe in my book. That's exactly why you have a resistance today within Ukraine against Kiev and the Zelensky regime, which is not a Russian resistance. It's a Ukrainian resistance against the Ukrainian government of Kiev. So, and they cooperate with the Russian resistance. There is also a Russian resistance in Ukraine. And both Ukrainian and Russian cooperate, but these are distinct movements. It is very important to understand that. So we are talking about a situation in Ukraine, which is much more complex than what we figure out in our media. As a result, it might be that in the aftermath of a conflict or after a negotiation or a negotiated solution to the conflict, we might have some surprises in the West, because we might well be led to fight against those we used to help against the Russians. So it's a more complex situation that we tend to figure out, I think. And that's very, as I said, it's very important to understand that.
Carl, shifting the gear to the Middle East, with what has happened so far, considering the policies of the European countries, and specifically I'm talking about Germany, France, and United Kingdom, do you understand what do they want from Netanyahu and his administration? Do you understand what are they trying to do in Gaza? Because the situation in Gaza, it's just unbelievable. You cannot see the scenes, the everything, the destruction, the starvation, whatever is happening there is just beyond imagination. How can they understand, how they can not do anything in terms of what's going on in Gaza?
Well, when you talk about France and Germany, remember these are two countries which during Second World War had an active participation in the Holocaust, both countries. Institutionally, I mean. France had a regime that cooperated institutionally with the Germans, and Germany was Germany. So, meaning that today, those two countries try to avoid to be qualified as anti-Semitic and things like this. This has become kind of a pathology in those two countries. They haven't really cut with the past. I think that's the whole drama of the whole situation. If you add to the fact that France, as an example, is both the most the biggest Muslim country in Europe and the biggest Jewish country in Europe. So that's where you have the largest Muslim community and the largest Jewish community. The Jewish community in France is heavily involved in the media. And you can assume that most of the media, in fact, are driven by individuals from the Jewish community. But at the same time, you have this huge Muslim community that has been also, let's say, kept in kind of underdevelopment in France. It's not exactly that. I shouldn't be so harsh, but we are more or less in that direction. That we wanted, I mean, the French wanted to have cheap labor, so they let those North Africans, Moroccans, Algerians, so on, coming into France, but they never managed them. As a result, you have a kind of second-class citizens that are currently in France. And you see that every single problem that you have in France starts to be has a nationalist flavor suddenly. I mean, we had, it was just last Saturday or so, or Friday, I'm not so a fan of soccer, but you had the PSG, championship, French championship, or things like that. I may be wrong on that because I'm absolutely not following soccer or football, depending on where you are. But the fact of the matter is that after the match, they had a huge riot in France. in Paris especially, and they started to burn cars and attack stores, and it was like as you have in a civil war, something like that, and people were fighting and shooting fireworks and things like this. I mean, fireworks not for joy, but firing, using fireworks as firearms, so to say. But interestingly enough, when you look at the picture of those riots, that in fact were triggered by this soccer match, you see the Palestinian flag everywhere. Meaning that every single social event can translate into a political problem. And the French government has never acknowledged that. As a result, they have a conflictual situation in France, which is very strong, and a polarized situation between the Muslims and the Jewish community. And since the Jewish minority is closer to the power than the Muslim, then you have this kind of partisan approach to the conflict in Israel or in Palestine. And you see that every time you have an initiative at the parliament to, for instance, to declare the Palestinian state or recognize or the Palestinian state or things like this, you have people in the government or close to the government or media that would strongly react to that. And they never manage to have an approach that would also keep this Muslim minority quiet. See, this is if you see, I don't have if I have here a chart because there is. Oh, I think it's here. Yes, I can. It's in French, unfortunately, but it's I think it's very interesting. If you look at anti-Semitic activities in France, you see the peaks here. All the peaks of anti-Semitic acts. I'm not going into the details how you define those anti-Semitic acts and things like this because they might have different definition. But the interesting point is that when you go deeper, you see that those peaks reflect every time a military operation in the Gaza Strip. Meaning that the impact of the Palestinian conflict on the domestic security situation in France is very strong. But nevertheless, the government in France has never wanted to realize this. They never wanted to acknowledge that there is a relationship, and therefore they keep supporting the Israeli government, and instead of trying to work, because my personal view is that if you support the Palestinians, it's not just supporting the Palestinians, it's also supporting the international law. Because everybody understands that Israel is violating the international humanitarian law, or the law of war, if you prefer. Therefore, we have to understand that it's not just a matter of being pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli or pro-whoever. It's also about being in favor of the international law or not. But the West preferred to forget about the international law in order not to be accused of anti-Semitism, because that's the first accusation you will receive in France if you even mention the fact that the Israel is not doing right. And that's exactly the problem. And in Germany, it's even worse. Meaning that those countries, I think they understand that things are going wrong. They understand that there is disrespect regarding international law by Israel. They understand that recognizing the Palestinian state would be a solution for that, as an example, as other measures, like cutting the support for weapons and things like this. But they don't dare to do it because then they would be accused of anti-Semitism and things like this. And that's exactly what they try to fight against. The problem is that in the West, we, first of all, people don't understand the history of Palestine. We have accepted the Israeli version, I would say even distortion of history, instead of going back to the historical facts and understanding the crisis from an international law point of view. We still see the problem from a political point of view. And making the analysis of the conflict based on law instead of politics would help considerably, but we don't dare to do so. And it's very interesting that in France, as an example, I don't know better or much better the situation in Germany, but in France, most of the commentators on the Palestinian situation are in fact people of Jewish extraction. You see? So they comment the situation in Israel from their point of view. And that doesn't reflect exactly when I see, and if you read my book, the Al-Aqsa Flood Operation, I make a lot of criticism about the way the French understand the conflict. They don't want to understand the conflict. That's the same as for the Ukrainian conflict. Everything is based on a narrative, not on facts, on a narrative. And the narrative has become the rule. I mean, if you look at history and you look at all the resolution of the United Nations, for instance, how can you say that the UN gave land to the Jews? It's not true. UN has never given a single square meter to the Jews. They gave the opportunity to the Jews to create a state under the conditionality that you had a democratic process and referendums among the Arab and Jewish population at the time. But they never gave any square meter to the Jews. And that's very important. But in France, a lot of people, even scholars, tell you what, you know, the Jews were given this territory and now the Palestinians are not happy with that. You see, there is a distortion of history there. And this distortion has become the rule. As long as we will not go back to the fundamentals, as long as we don't go back to the historical facts, as long as we don't want to accept the rule of the international law as Israel promised to follow in 1949, I mean, there will be no solution to the conflict. And France is certainly not the first country to do that. Even if Macron said we should, now he's saying we should probably recognize the state of Israel, but he makes no effort to do so.
The state of Palestine.
The thing is that in France, not institutionally, but by, let's say, practice, the president accumulates the role of president, but also he's in charge specifically on the defense policy and the foreign policy, which are, in fact, the two fundamental elements of the security policy. He has a Minister of Foreign Affairs, he has a Minister of Defense, but somehow the practice is that the president overrules those ministers. They are just therefore implementing decisions made by the president. Meaning that Emmanuel Macron could take influence in order to make a decision to recognize the state of Palestine. It's not the same in countries such as, for instance, Switzerland, where the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has no precedence over the other ministers and things like this, or in Germany. You need to have here a balance, a political balance. In France, the president could decide, but it hasn't. Meaning that when he says that, yes, we should recognize the state of Palestine, it's just words. And he will probably backtrack the day after, because that's the way it is. You say one thing and exactly this exactly opposite the next day. So this relates very much to what we said before about the leadership in Europe. You have people you cannot really trust because they don't have a real strategy to address problems. Defense, security policy, industrial policy, economic policy, you name it. They don't have a line. They don't have an identifiable line. And that's, we have mentioned that several times about the conflict in Ukraine. Because even in the US, they have objective, but they don't have strategy. And we are back to the very first question you addressed me today. This is the Western leadership at large, both political and military, is not used to think strategically. We are used to think tactically. We take decision from day to day. We don't have long-term ideas that we want to achieve in the long run, a national vision on things that could be, for instance, supported by referendum, and meaning that because the problem in democracies is that the leadership is renewed every 4 years or 5 years or whatever. But if you had a referendum based on population that says, okay, over the 20 years, we want to achieve that over 20 years. That could override the change of political parties and things, because then those different government, the different people who are elected and so on, they would be bound by the decision taken by the population. So we could solve that with kind of institutional solutions, but we don't do it. We keep to have a tactical understanding of problems, and we try to solve problems tactically, meaning that it's a small measure here, a small measure there, and things like this. All the problems we're talking about, it can be Palestine, it could be Ukraine, it could be others, even the economic problem, especially the economic problem, by the way. They're holistic, meaning that these are problems that needs to be addressed in a multidimensional fashion. Yeah. It's all of government approach. It is multidimensional, and you need to address those problems on different. You need to have one line, but a lot of different approach that feeds the same line, if I can put it that way. As you have the branch of a tree, they all feed the same tree, but all the branches are different, all the leaves are different. And this scheme of action is definitely not what you have in our current government, where everybody has its own vision on things. That's why you have government that's even in the same government, you have people who say A, the other says B, and the third one says C. So how can you achieve any consistency if in the same government three individuals have three different visions? So this is exemplified by the fact that we don't know how to achieve objective, because we don't have objectives. We talked about Ukraine. What is the objective of the Europeans? Continue war? Is that an objective? You know, what do they want to achieve? How do you imagine? How do you figure out the way to get out of the conflict? Nobody has said so. Of course, they talk about the victory of Ukraine, but what is the victory? What does it mean concretely, specifically, factually? How do you define the victory of Ukraine? What can be considered as a victory? What can be, could be considered as a defeat of Russia? Nobody is able to define this. They don't have even an understanding of what they say. So when you have people who lead policies like this, they cannot achieve any results because they don't even know what they want to achieve. Therefore, they cannot, when you don't know what you want to achieve, it's very hard for you to define a strategy to go to that point.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Carl, and congratulations on your new book, and which would be available tomorrow in English on Amazon. And
thank has you been very really much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem. Thank you. That was a pleasure to be invited. Thank you.
Take care.